safety nets. Let me see. Project is funded by talent development grant from Stimulating Fund. Creative Industry Fund NL. Thank you, Stimulating Fund and the Netherlands for making this possible.
In today's internet landscape, where personal data and privacy are constantly at risk, how can users from marginalized communities protect their online identities? Welcome to the podcast Safety Nets, Let Me Seen. In the second episode, I'll be talking with an artist, Eloisa Guerrero, about her recent workshop for Filipino caregivers and migrant workers in Canada to protect their privacy on big social network platforms. Hello, Eloisa. How are you? I guess it's in the evening in Toronto, right? Our recording is now remotely done, as we live very far each other.
Yeah, it's a cold and rainy night here. And thanks for inviting me to speak on your podcast.
I'm grateful to have you on my radio. We met in the peer-to-peer festival along with a residency program in CO Berlin some years ago. And since then, we've been staying in touch and working together. For listeners who don't have enough context about you, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure, yeah. Hi, my name is Eloisa Guerrero. I am an artist primarily working with media and software. I also work as a digital accessibility specialist.
Thanks. So indeed, we also actually worked together at the ZinCamp Festival. It was to do a skill sharing, the basic web coding techniques in HTML and CSS. And the main focus of the workshop was to introduce semantic HTML principles to participants, like how to make a website accessible by using semantic HTML tags, which are text that can be recognized by web browsers so that screen reader users can also experience the website without barriers. And I was mostly in charge of giving the participants basic knowledge of writing HTML and CSS code. And the importance of semantic HTML part was mostly done by you, as you're part of the accessibility guidelines working group. I remember people were very into learning it from you. And now I wonder, how has been your exploration in the web accessibility going on? And also, are you engaged in any other working groups?
Yeah, I'm part of a couple of other working groups, mostly those related to assistive technologies, as well as the Sustainable Web Interest Group. I'm not as active as I'd like to be, but I try to pay attention to what goes on in those groups. Right now, there's a lot of movement in the accessibility space because of the enforcement of EAA, the European Accessibility Act, and it requires businesses and organizations that provide goods and services to the European Union to meet a certain level standard according to the W3C's Web Content Accessibility Guideline.
I remember already when we met for the first time, you shared your study notes, how you actually researched web accessibility with me, and you really care this user site. For me, by then, this accessibility on the web was quite a new thing. It seems like you're quite involved in ethical activities in the digital space. Before getting into main questions, it'd be still nice to get to know you just a little more. How come have you been diving into software art and handmade web scene practices?
Sure, yeah. Well, software art is basically just an umbrella term I use to talk about artworks that are made digitally or through computation beyond the web and net-based art. I consider anything that is programmable as software. So I grew up on the internet making web pages for fun, and I still find it a lot of fun, and that's why I still try to do it on my own personal projects. And I also make zines, and it's not uncommon to bring that sort of format to digital because hypermedia and hypertext have such unique features, such as using nonlinear narratives or interactive media. So it's quite a lot of fun. I've also been working with Twine, which is a software that creates nonlinear narratives or games, or I use it for zines. So it's a type of like electronic literature that you can only make through websites or through software.
I deeply feel connection with you in that you actually started to make web pages for fun.
Like when I first tried to learn HTML, I was just looking at other people's websites and then copying them and trying to figure out there. I didn't read a formal book or a course. I learned from copying other people. And that was a lot of figuring out what things meant or how things were working. And nowadays, I try to read documentation and try to understand it better. But it's still a lot of fun to tinker and change things here and there, not just in terms of code, but also in terms of, you know, user interface or design. And
yeah, your narrative.
Yeah, you're never done. So it's always a lot of fun to keep changing, constantly change things.
Yeah, true. You also mentioned in the end, like this unique feature of the web, such as hypertext and hypermedia. And yeah, for instance, linking to another page, that's actually really a true charm, because I feel like you're really doing a journey. You're moving to another dimension of space, right? This is also maybe a similar or extended question. What does it mean to you that you're making your websites on your own? And I know you have also a bit of skills to host your own web server. I wonder what does it mean to you, such activities?
Well, I guess with the way the internet is right now, and we were forewarned by the inventors and the pioneers of the internet that currently we move around in a very centralized, very concentrated set of networks, and we're on more apps.
True.
You know, like we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. And most of the servers on the internet that these apps and websites run on are owned by a very select few. And so if these servers go down, the internet is at a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
Just the other week, Amazon Web Services, or AWS, was down for a few hours, and it suspended daily operations from all over the world. And so for me, making my own websites and running things or hosting things locally is a form of resistance and a form of play as well.
Yeah, true. Actually, it's really crazy when we now think of the world where we live in, you know, things are super centralized. This is even not a new story or not a surprise. In South Korea, there is a really centralized social network platform called KakaoTalk. I'm not sure if you heard of it, but
yeah,
a few
I've heard
years
of it.
Ago, you heard of it? Yeah. A few years ago, the data center of KakaoTalk had a fire. The thing is that before that, they didn't ever distribute their infrastructure all over the other places. So the data center was totally off for some days. And the thing is that in Korean society, everything works with this KakaoTalk infrastructure, like taxi driver also connected to the KakaoTalk business. We are highly relying on this kind of platform. So yeah, when the data center got this fire, it was really kind of chance for many people to realize how we are so relying on such kind of big platform. For me, indeed, also making your own web pages or trying to run your own server, studying it, of course, it's never perfect. It's clumsy. There are a lot of errors, but it gives me freedom in a way. I guess it's the same for you.
Yeah, I agree. Like in terms of the centralized networks in the Philippines, everything runs on Facebook. Businesses, government agencies use Facebook to provide services or to give information. Like that's the main source of information that a lot of Filipinos get their news from.
Oh, I actually didn't know. In Philippines, there's like a lot of people's lives are intertwined to Facebook.
Yeah.
Indeed, now this is maybe good timing to get into the main point. There's something that I really wanted to learn from you as for this. as you know, my current project is about exploring how people's self-expression and privacy matters online has been evolving on the web landscape transformation. And I also aim to research how autonomous site operators can strengthen protective layers on their website. However, unfortunately, today's internet is facing a lot of fears about our privacy, like how our personal data is processed and what users and creators can do in order to prevent information leakage, etc. So how do you see the urgency of the privacy issues on the web? Maybe this is a bit too general question, but yeah.
It's very concerning because a lot of, say, artists rely on places like Instagram to promote themselves and to promote their art. And unfortunately, we are at the mercy of the company that maintains and operates these apps. So, you know, they often change their user rules and agreement to sneakily add in stuff like, by posting, you are allowing us to run this through our AI, you know, like everyone is at the mercy of these centralized platforms. And yeah, it's very difficult to try to balance being able to promote yourself and keeping operations working while at the same time making your own content and your own information private and secure.
Mm-hmm.
There's really not a bulletproof way to protect yourself when you're on these platforms. The best advice is to not be on these platforms at all, but that's not easy, right?
Because that's not easy.
Yeah.
You just mentioned right now a really interesting aspect, which is that we live in an era that keep promoting ourselves because of maybe economical pressure. Also, there's maybe some useful information that is shared on such platform. We don't want to miss it out. There's also this kind of feeling that you don't want to miss out, like a FOMO. It's very not easy to divorce. So this is now a natural bridge to talk about your recent workshop, because that was the main part that I wanted to introduce to the listeners. So I know some month ago you hosted a workshop which is for Filipino migrant workers living in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was for CCESO, Caregiver Connections Education and Support Organization, right? Could you please elaborate what the workshop was for? And if I'm not correctly phrasing something, please also correct me.
Sure, yeah. So like what I mentioned earlier, Facebook is pretty much a daily driver for many Filipinos. And that goes the same for migrant workers who live abroad and use it to keep in contact with their friends and their family, to keep up with the news from back home. And that means it becomes a very rich breeding ground for scams, phishing, and mis and disinformation.
Yeah.
And the workshop was mostly to inform participants of the common ways that they may or have already been targeted through these. Some of them are very elaborate scams. And so we kind of went through the different very common types of scams that people often experience, and we also showed them ways to do a lot more fact checking, to direct them to more reliable news outlets and sources, so that they are more critical of the information that they get from Facebook, even if it is, you know, coming from their friends or family.
Yeah, I know a friend, she actually works in Facebook, and her job is to filter like a violent or a sexually harassed content. And I think there are different departments in the Facebook group, like a per region of the world, like a Middle East area and like a Western European area. And then she is working for Turkish department, and her task is to filter such crazy violent content. Working for that is really stressful for her. But yeah, it's really crazy. Without such control, it's really mess. It's really like almost like a bombard, which is really not good. And indeed, maybe there would be reasons that people of group of immigrants or migrant workers, they are more situated in vulnerable position to be scammed, you know. actually it's not about their personal thing, it's all this geopolitical environment aspect. So at the moment, I want to ask you, why did you want to touch the urgency that there are barriers for the migrant workers? What made you to specifically pinpoint the migrant workers? Because there are many other groups of users on the internet.
As a Filipino immigrant myself, I am very much aware of the danger and the precarity that migrant workers face, especially since they are very far away from their families and their places of home. So they are in a very vulnerable situation where their point of contact or their connection to these people and places are very concentrated in places like Facebook, WhatsApp, very centralized networks. And a lot of scammers know this, and that's why it's very common for them to target these people specifically, especially for those who remit or send money back home.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a huge source of income that gets deducted from their paycheck.
I guess this is maybe one of the most common kind of narratives, the scam or phishing online.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also a lot of these scams are also ways to make more money, you know, because in the geopolitical sense that Filipinos are often taken advantage of, paying them the Philippine wage instead of, or like the global South wage compared to the global North wage, you know, like, because labor is so cheap in the Philippines, they are often...
Yeah, a lot of people in the Philippines can speak really good English.
Yeah,
so they have
yeah.
capacities to work in the global context already, but then their economical, how do I say, context is still not in a parallel with the global context.
For sure. Yeah, there was I saw a news item the other day about stores in the US or North America hiring Filipinos to become virtual cashiers in restaurants and shops. Like the restaurants and shops would have tiny monitors and the Filipinos would be the ones operating that from the Philippines because their labor is so cheap.
Mm.
It's cheaper to hire virtual cashiers from the Philippines than to hire actual cashiers in North America.
Oh.
That's how easy it is to take advantage of them, you know? And there were even some posts on Instagram of these CEOs or I forget, but they would often boast about paying their secretaries from the Philippines a very low wage. And then they would reap the benefits of that work, you know? Basically, they offload all of their manual labor to these assistants, paying them wages in the Philippines instead of global North wages. And that, it's just, it's very extractive. It's very, it's taking advantage of these people. And so that's become a very common thing that's been going on. And in terms of, for example that you talked about, people monitoring Facebook for filtering out content. There was actually a documentary called The Cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about about the dark side of these Facebook like auditing. So a lot of Filipinos were hired to screen these very disturbing media and material before, in order to block them from being posted publicly. And a lot of it involved psychological damage to these people because they were not given any sort of, you know, care or therapy or, you know, any sort of like help for them to recover from having seen such atrocious imagery. And that's another form of extractiveness that happens because they can pay them so little and not give them any health benefits but still reap the rewards from their labor.
Huh. This is really frustrating to even hear. Sometimes I just think that there are a lot of polarizations in our society.
Yeah.
All this unfairness in our physical living context is just transferred into the digital space. It's just the same. Also, we are now talking about this phishing and online violence and who are more vulnerable and so on. And we never can say that this is only a personal matter. Like, it's not that they are maybe not wise or not smart enough. So we can never say this because it's like such a societal aspect.
Yeah, it is. As well as the disinformation machine in the Philippines is very sophisticated. It's actually more, it's not just one or two bad apples giving bad information or propaganda to people. It's actually a very well orchestrated machine driven by, you know, by very specific groups who have political agendas. So, for example, the Duterte election was pretty much a result of the disinformation machine on Facebook. A lot of information or a lot of propaganda on Facebook that was circulated around that time was very pro-Duterte. And it's still there. That's still happening right now. There's still a lot of examples of disinformation like that. And it's hard because some of it will come from people that you know and trust. Because people will also just repost without thinking, without fact-checking or double-checking their information. It's very easy to just repost and send it to other people on your network. And it'll just circulate, right? It kind of takes on a life of its own. And that's how it goes in a circle, right?
Yeah, I think for people who have very much like a desperate desire in their economic state, it would be very hard to avoid to get it. Yeah, it's really frustrating.
Yeah, it's not necessarily just people who lack the education to be able to ascertain whether information is correct or not. This is even the most educated, the most aware people can still be tricked into believing certain things. It's really the persuasiveness of these campaigns can be very sneaky and can be very, it's difficult to undermine, no matter what educational level you are. Because again, this could also come from sources that you trust. And so you have that bias. You have your own personal biases that kind of work against you.
Yeah, people tend to believe things as they wanna believe.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really not cut and dry. It's not just a matter of lack of education.
Well, I aim to eventually talk about the positive future.
Yeah.
That's actually the fact. Yeah, it's the reality.
Yeah.
So to change the topic to a little more practical scope, now I would like to ask you, what kinds of activities did you provide with the participants?
So we had like an impromptu activity where we printed very comical templates of Facebook, like text box.
Interface.
And we asked the participants to create their own Facebook scams that maybe they've seen, heard about, or maybe even experienced themselves. So they drew this or wrote it on pieces of paper, and then they shared it. And they also shared their own stories and their own, you know, close calls with these scams. And it just goes to show how it doesn't target anyone in particular. It can be anyone, anywhere, and it can be very convincing.
And do you remember any of the shared phishing experiences of the participants?
Yeah. One of them, I think they were trying to sell her something. And actually, I don't remember off the top of my head. I think it's someone was impersonating another person. And she gave like a very personal or asked a very personal question that only that person would know. And they did not give the correct answer, basically. And so she realized that it was not the person that she knew. It was someone imitating or impersonating that person.
Mm.
It was actually very scary. At the end of the workshop, some of them felt very scared and hopeless, you know, like, because this isn't going to stop anytime soon. It's going to keep happening. And it is scary if you're not vigilant about it. I guess another thing is that, like what I mentioned with migrant workers, it's become, since the 1970s, there's been like a huge exodus of Filipino migrant workers.
Yeah.
That started with the dictatorship of Marcos Sr. And it has not stopped since then. It's only gotten worse. More and more people are forced to move abroad to work, you know, to leave their families and their homes because the living wage in the Philippines is just not enough to sustain them and their families. So, yeah, it's, you know, a lot of immigrants did not really want to leave. You know, that was not really their choice.
But living in a new context is very hard, challenging. You also know it because you are also, you now are based in Toronto, Canada, but you live as a Filipino person. And I also have been living in Europe for many years as an East Asian.
Mm-hmm.
We all know this pressure, how big it is.
Yeah.
Well, I've been living in Europe, like Western Europe, for 10 years, but I am still struggling with adjusting myself to such cloudy, rainy weather in autumn and winter. Mm-hmm. It's even harder for you because you are indeed from this tropical country. So, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And it's not just, you know, it's not just cultural, but also environmental, you know. For example, winter. Winter is very difficult for people from the tropical countries. And that's something that you will never get used to, I think. I will never get used to it.
Now it's getting a little different direction.
Yeah,
never get used to it.
Yeah, we don't have winter. We only have two seasons, rainy season and summer. Because of climate change too, yeah.
Yeah, we have been talking about the weather as an example of the cultural difficulty in living as a foreigner in another place.
Yeah.
But the point we wanted to address is that living abroad is not always necessarily chosen by themselves. Some people make the decision since it's just inevitable. Yeah, back to the flow. As a summary of your workshop, did you also discuss some useful tips to prevent the online phishing and make some privacy protections on such big tech platforms?
It's don't believe everything you see or hear, even if it's coming from friends or family. It doesn't cost anything to do a web search, to do some fact checking. You're better off doing that rather than just, you know, mindlessly reposting or regurgitating false or malicious information to other people. And it could be harmful, you know, to do that more so than just doing a simple Google search. And always being vigilant and being aware of the political landscape that we're in, because that will always control the narrative, especially in Facebook, where the algorithm will be giving you news or fake news or, you know, propaganda. And yeah, it's a lot of that. And as well as limiting the number of people, not just the number, but the limiting your audience, limiting the audience who can access you or your content. Because, again, any sort of like personal information that you give can and will be used against you. It can become the next phishing scam. And so being more careful about what kind of personal information you give out to the public is going to be very important.
Cool. True, you need to be aware of the political landscape you're situated. Also, what I find especially useful from what you've said is that we should also be more conscious of to whom we are making our content accessible. Thanks. So yeah, I have the last question, which is, how do you speculate about the internet as a public space? What are the hopes we can still keep despite the dangers?
I mean, the internet is a space that should be for all. And that means that it belongs to each and every one of us. And just like public spaces, it's a shared ownership. And we all play a role in digital stewardship to make sure that we create and foster safe environments for different types of people from all walks of life. And that means being careful about what you share, who you share it to, the things that you say or the things that you don't say, you know, things like that. And understanding that somebody can or will see, you know, everything that you post on the internet, and understanding repercussions of being visible on the internet. That's kind of like dystopian, but well, it started utopian and then became dystopian. But in the end, the bottom line is that the internet can be what we make it to be. So it's also within our power to turn it into a better place. And yeah, it's going to be difficult because, again, there are very few people in power who hold that authority. And that's why I think making websites and hosting your own things is, again, like a form of resistance and a form of play. I think these apps and these platforms are not there for us to enjoy ourselves. It's to sell us things, right? Yeah, and I think we need to take it back and do things that are not for profit necessarily, and is to make our place richer and more colorful, and not as a shopping mall or a place, you know, or a place to scam each other. You know, like,
that's such a sweet metaphor.
I think that was the dream that Tim Berners-Lee originally had for the World Wide Web. And I think that's something we should slowly try to get back into.
Yes, as you just said, the fact that the web is highly ruled by only a few people who have power and capital sometimes makes me feel a little helpless. But this is, on the other hand, a reason why the autonomous activities matter. Therefore, I really hope that what we're talking about gets more and more widely spread out. And yes, thank you very much. It was very great to learn your insight through this episode. Also, what you shared today makes me reflect about how the economic and geopolitical environments of a group of people in the world influence the online dimension of their lives. And I hope we collaborate for something else again in the near future.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
So thanks again and stay in touch.
Thank you. Bye.
Safety Nets, Let Me See project is funded by talent development grant from Stimulating Fund, Creative Industry Fund NL. Thank you, Stimulating Fund and the Netherlands, for making this possible.